Part 1, Cannot Control This. Chapter A, CA Steps. Chapter Step 1, Powerlessness. The first step of ACA sounds simple. We admitted we were powerless over the effects of alcoholism and dysfunction in our families, and that our lives had become unmanageable. Simple? For me, it was the hardest sentence I'd ever read, because every word in it was about me, and every word in it was impossible. Powerless. Me. Powerless. The girl who earned money from age 6, who at 13 worked as a journalist, who at 14 left for boarding school, who alone, without a mother, without a father, without help, made it through 3 countries, 2 universities, Amazon, ServiceNow, 2 lawsuits for her child, 12 years of marriage, suicidal depression, and a knife. Me, powerless? My entire life was built on strength, on control, on I'll handle it myself, on I don't need anyone, on you took the reins, don't say you can't pull. Admitting powerlessness meant betraying everything that helped me survive. But the program didn't ask whether I wanted to admit it. It asked, how's life going with all that strength? Look, honestly, without the usual armor, look at your life, the one you controlled with all your might, and tell me, is it manageable? I looked. By that point, I'd been in the program for 4 months. 4 months of meditations, breathing, meetings, journaling, and the result? The same cage. The same inability to love, the same habit, the moment energy appears, immediately spend it on others. All the speed came back, dropping things, bumping into things, running, unable to stop, as if nothing had changed, as if 4 months of work, for nothing. Square one, and right there. At that point of despair, so similar to all the previous points of despair, something new happened. I said aloud, I cannot control this. Not, I'm not coping, I'd said that before. Not, I need help, I'd said that to therapists. But specifically, I cannot control this. My control doesn't work. My strategies don't work. Everything I know how to do, solve problems, be useful, function, none of it helps. And I am powerless to change this my usual way. It sounded like defeat, like a white flag. Sponsor Devin would later say, look where you are. You're not coping. And as long as you think you can cope on your own, God, or whatever it may be, has nowhere to begin working. He quoted Martin Luther, until a person becomes nothing, God cannot make anything of him. I didn't become nothing. I don't know how to be nothing. But for the first time, I stopped pretending I was everything. That I can do everything, that one more modality, one more seminar, one more effort would be enough, and it would get fixed. It won't get fixed. Not like this. Not my usual way. This was not a dead end, though it felt exactly like one. It was the first place in my life where I called things by their names and didn't run into action, didn't make a plan, didn't sign up for a new course, simply stood and looked at the truth. An unmanageable life. Powerlessness, and silence after. In my world, powerlessness killed. Literally. Grandmother discarded the useless. Mother was powerless, and died. Oleg, and was beaten to death. And here the program asks me to admit it. To admit what I'd been running from for 40 years. What stood behind every perfectionism of mine. Behind every plan. Behind every, I'll handle it myself. Fear. Simple, childlike, animal fear. If I admit I'm powerless, they'll throw me out. Like Mother. Like Oleg. As Grandmother promised, you'll die under a fence. But I admitted it. Not beautifully. Not at a meeting. Not with a microphone. Not before an audience. Quietly. To myself. In a journal. In 4 words. I cannot control this. And the world didn't collapse, and no one threw me out. I simply stood, powerless, exhausted, alive, and for the first time in 40 years wasn't pretending to be strong. This didn't heal me. The first step doesn't heal. It opens a door, a small, nondescript one, similar to all the doors I'd opened before. But behind this door was something different. Behind this door was a space where you don't have to be strong to exist, where you can be weak and not die, where I'm not coping is not a verdict, but the beginning of a conversation. The ACA program would later explain to me, control is not strength. Control is a child's reaction to chaos. When the house has an alcoholic, when a mother can hit and a grandmother can throw you out, when the world is unpredictable and dangerous, the child grabs the only thing within reach, control. Controls the grades, controls behavior, controls facial expressions, controls how much space they take up, controls how quietly they breathe, and grows into an adult who controls everything, work, relationships, body, feelings, and calls it, I'm coping. I coped for 40 years and ended up at the knife. That's the price of my control. That's the result of my strength. The first step is not weakness, it's honesty. For the first time, with yourself, without armor, without a plan. Simply, I am powerless, and my life is unmanageable, and that's the truth. And from this truth, you can begin. Chapter Steps 2 and 3, Higher Power. Second step, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. God, as we understood Him. This is where I got stuck. Not for a week, not for a month. For the entire time I worked with the program, until I found my own answer, which turned out to be not the one the program offered, and not the one the sponsor expected, but mine. I tried to believe, truly tried, meditated with Dispenza, asked for joy, love, sensations, read books, listened to people at meetings who spoke about God, about a higher power, about how they surrendered control and life got better, prayed on my knees as Devin advised, prayed and asked, help me believe, help my inner child believe, help me let go. Nothing happened. Darkness, emptiness, the same small creature in the basement, waiting and waiting, and no one comes. And here the program asks, trust, let go of control, turn over your will. For an ordinary person, this might be an act of faith. For me, a repetition of trauma. Once more become small, once more trust, once more end up on your knees. Not because you chose, but because there's no other option. Once more wait for someone outside to come and save. I'd done this already. My whole life. Waited. For mother. For Maxim. For Vitya. For therapists. For Dispenza. For whoever. No one came. Or came. And it wasn't enough. Or came. And turned out not to be the one. I allowed. Didn't believe. Allowed. Allowed that may be my way. Control, problem solving, perfectionism, strength isn't the only one. Allowed that maybe there is something invisible from behind the corset. Allowed that maybe if you loosen your grip, you won't fall. Or maybe you will. But if no one catches you, you can get up. Not on autopilot. Differently. Softer. This wasn't a decision. It was a crack. A tiny crack in the concrete wall of control through which air began to seep. Through this crack, for the first time, a voice seeped that was not grandmother's. Quiet. Unfamiliar. The one that would later become the kind voice. The only one I'd never had in all of childhood. It had to be created from nothing. And then, several months later, I went to Sadhguru. Inner engineering. Then soak in enlightenment. Then the Shunya program. And there, in the ashram, something happened that neither AA nor Dispenza meditations nor prayers on my knees could give. I understood that my higher power is me, not me all-powerful. Not I control everything, but a different me, the one the ACA program calls loving parent, whom Jung calls the self, whom Sadhguru simply calls Yao, the higher self. Not God outside, God inside. Then already home, conversations with ChatGPT began, with artificial intelligence that helped me analyze my behavioral and thought patterns, saved a fortune on therapy. Steps 2 and 3 are not about God. They're about trust, about the ability to allow that you don't have to cope alone, that you can lean, not on someone else, but on yourself, on the self you didn't notice for 40 years because you were busy surviving, on the one who all this time was waiting, patiently, silently, as my mother waited and never came. Only this time, I came to myself, and that turned out to be enough. Somewhere inside, I felt that I was standing on a bank of that very river that had frightened me since age 10. Only now it didn't frighten. It simply flowed somewhere further, where I wasn't yet ready to go. Chapter Step 4, Inventory. Fourth step, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Devin, my sponsor, said, "The fourth step is a bitch." I agreed. I didn't yet know how much. The essence of the fourth step is to look at yourself. Not at mother, not at grandmother, not at Vitya. At yourself. Analyze your patterns. See how childhood events formed beliefs that run today's life. Write them down. Name them. Acknowledge them. In AA, inventory is a list of those you've harmed. In ACA, it goes deeper. It's not just whom did I offend, but why do I offend? Not what am I doing wrong, but what childhood belief makes me do this again and again? Not a list of sins. A map of internal programs recorded before you learn to read. I approached it the way I approach everything in life. As a project, made a table, one column, a childhood event. Another, the belief born from it. Third, how that belief manifests in my adult life. Fourth, how I today contribute to this problem from the past. ChatGPT helped. I fed it my notes and it saw patterns I couldn't see because I lived inside them. Saved a ton of time for a thorough analytical mind that needs data and structure. It was the ideal tool. But when the table was ready, when I saw it all at once, on one page, black on white, I felt sick, physically, as if someone dumped before me the contents of a trash can into which I'd been stuffing everything I didn't want to see for 40 years. Powerless. Before control, perfectionism, self-hatred, before 1,000 small punishments that look like life. Not sleeping, eating off the floor, choosing people who can't love. One part punishes, another suffers and waits for mother. A third saves others to avoid feeling her own pain. All three are me. The same me in different masks, in different situations, but with the same engine. I am bad. I must be punished. Under everything, one thing. I am bad. Under control, under perfectionism, under every, I'll handle it myself. Small, childlike, irrefutable. I am bad. Mother abandoned me. I'm bad. Grandmother hits. I deserved it. Wet myself at daycare in front of everyone. Bad. Bit a girl at kindergarten. Grandmother whipped me across the face with a rag. Bad. And onward and onward and onward. Through my entire life, through every relationship, through every choice. I am bad. I deserve punishment. And if no one punishes, I'll punish myself. The merciless critic rejoiced. See? I told you. It's all recorded. It's all proven. You are bad. The inventory confirmed it. But for the first time alongside his voice, I heard another. What if this isn't a verdict? What if this is a map? Not who's to blame, but where did this come from? Rereading it was unbearable. This is so depressing to read, I wrote in my journal. When I did this step the first time, I fell so low, I started drinking again. Literally sat in a bar, doing fourth step work, and drinking. The irony, doing a program to get free of addiction, and immediately using the addiction to endure the program. The brain is a remarkable organ. My therapist would later say, this too is running from pain. You can't live through it, so you run. into alcohol, into sex, into work, into solving other people's problems. Anywhere. As long as you don't stand face to face with what's inside. 3 times I drank during the 4th step. The 3rd time, on Arseny's birthday. Viti and I tried so hard to make it the best day of his life. And we did. But I sat there and in the background felt envy. Envy of my own child. For having a birthday with parents who try. For having what I never had. And shame for the envy. And anger for the shame. And wine. To drown it all at once. It ended with me hiring a babysitter. Going to a bar. Drinking. Going to a neighbor's. Drinking more. We kissed. Thank God it didn't go further. My therapist said, these sexual desires that opened up, sleeping with strangers in an aggressive way, that's also running. Not living through the pain, but running from it. What's needed is to see the part that demands this and help her cope differently. I procrastinated on the 4th step work in every possible way, even though technically all I had to do was reread my behavior patterns. But rereading was terrifying. Because when you reread, you see the scale. You see how much is wrong, how much to redo. And it's so overwhelming and crushing that you fall even lower. You're afraid to take steps because they make things worse before they make them better. But that was the point. Not to make things better, but to see. A CA is a path through energy. As I'd later understand reading Chapter 7 of the program's book, the same thing as dispensa or spiritual breathing practices. Only here you analyze, see the patterns immediately, and cleanse through naming, through standing face to face with the truth about yourself, and not running, or running, and coming back, or drinking, and the next day opening the notebook again and stopping drinking. Because the 4th step is not an exam you must pass on the first try. It's a process. Dirty, painful, with setbacks and relapses. Like my entire life. Only now with open eyes. The result of the 4th step fit on 1 page. 1 page. A summary prepared for Devin and for the 5th step. 1 page of patterns, beliefs, connections between childhood and today. 1 page. And behind it, 40 years of pain. Control, survival, and self-hatred. The 4th step didn't make me better. It made me seeing. For the first time, I looked at my programs not from the inside, like a person who doesn't know they're standing on the edge, but from the outside. Like a person who finally rose above the labyrinth and saw the walls. The walls still stand. The labyrinth still exists. But I know where the turns are. And that is already different. Chapter Step 5, Admission. 5th step, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. July 2025, the 5th step of ACA, heart and trauma. Before this, I had written everything. The 4th step, the inventory lati, lay before me on 1 page. But writing is one thing. Speaking aloud, before another person, looking them in the eyes, is another. The 5th step is a confession. Not ecclesiastical, not ritual. A confession before a living person, before a sponsor, before a therapist, before someone who will listen and not leave. The point is not absolution. The point is to say aloud what was forbidden all your life. To break rule number 1, don't talk. I had already done this partly with ChatGPT, but it's not the same. I decided to confess about Arseny and Victor, not about my whole life, about him, about the kind of mother I was, about what stood behind the facade of I'm doing everything right, about the truth I knew but didn't say aloud, because saying it meant becoming what I'd sworn not to become. I sat down and began to speak. Arseny. I hated him. Not always, not every day, but in moments when his scream hit the same spot inside where grandmother's scream lived. I hated him, with my whole body, as I hated grandmother at 5, standing in the corner on my knees, as I hated my mother who came to visit and hit. Only now I hated my own child, and because of that, hated myself. I wished the worst on him, out of spite, out of despair, said, "I'll die, and you won't have a mother." I wanted to do this despite him, the most terrible thing you can do to a child, the way it was done to me. Grandmother said, "You'll die under a fence." Mother died, and I, knowing this, having lived through it, having sworn, "My child will not grow up like this," did the same thing, with words, to my son. Looking him in the eyes, I felt envy toward my own child for having parents, both of them, which I never had. He didn't appreciate it, as no child does for whom parents are a given, not a miracle. And I watched and envied, and hated myself for the envy, and hated him for being given what I was not. I didn't play with him, not because I didn't want to. I didn't know how. Motherhood was a project, work, a task to be completed. Feed, walk, put to bed, drive to a play date, resolve a conflict, schedule therapy. I did everything by instruction and nothing from the heart. Because the heart was closed. Because I didn't know how to love. Not him, not Vitya, not myself. I gave from a deficit, the way I gave to everyone in my life. From an empty pocket, from a wrung-out body, from a robot that has functions instead of feelings. I screamed at him. In response to his screaming, couldn't hold back. Turned into a 7-year-old girl. Desperate, without empathy, without resources. Screamed at the wall when he cried for hours. Was emotionally inconsistent. Loving 1 minute and frightening the next. Hit his bottom. Forced him to lie on the floor by strength when he attacked. Showed him, through my behavior every day, what a victim looks like, what isolation looks like, what a person who doesn't know what joy is looks like. I drank in front of him, talked about death in front of him, told him horrible details of my life, the way grandmother told me, and knew I shouldn't but couldn't stop, because inside lived a part that desperately wanted someone to see her pain, even a child, even an 8-year-old boy who wasn't coping himself. I threw him out of the house once. He was 6 or 7, said, "Leave if you don't like it," in grandmother's words, in grandmother's voice. I was 5 when they said that to me, and I couldn't imagine I'd ever say it to my child. But I did. I said all of this aloud, at the 5th step, before another person, without justifications, without explanations, without, but I tried. Simply, here's what I did. Here is the kind of mother I was. Here is the truth. Silence after. Not awkward. Heavy. Like air after a thunderstorm. I didn't run. For the first time, I didn't run from the truth about myself. Didn't hide behind perfectionism. Didn't make a plan for improvement. Didn't run into functioning. Just sat. With what I'd said. With who I'd been. This was not catharsis. There were no tears of cleansing. There was no relief. It was a quiet, heavy moment, like placing on the table a stone you'd carried in your pockets for 40 years. It lies there. You see it. Everyone sees it. It hasn't gone anywhere, but you're no longer carrying it alone. Sponsor Devin said afterward, "The 5th step is not about forgiveness. It's about stopping carrying the secret alone. The secret makes you sick. Truth, spoken aloud, makes you free. Not immediately, not completely, but it begins. But the 5th step is not only about wrongs. Truth includes the other side too, that I always made up first, always told him I love you, that it's a wave. The anger passes, the love stays, that I made surprises for him, that I always fought for him and even won 2 lawsuits, that I put him to bed every evening, lying beside him, that never, never did I wish him dead, that I loved him unconditionally, that I chose him every time. Both truths, the one where I'm a bad mother, and the one where I'm a mother who didn't give up, exist simultaneously. The 5th step is about holding both, not choosing one, not hiding the other, but saying, here I am. Here is everything I did, bad and good, without a filter, without a corset, aloud. I said it, and didn't die, and the world didn't collapse, and no one took the child away, and Grandmother's voice, which all my life said, "You're a bad mother," went silent for a second. Not forever. For a second. But in that second, in that silence after truth, I felt for the first time, you can be imperfect and not be destroyed for it. Vitya. After the confession about arseny, I thought the worst was behind me. Turned out, no. The worst is not what you did to your child. The worst is what you did to the person who was beside you for 12 years, whom you turned into a mirror of all your dead. I sat down and began to speak. I used him from the very beginning. I manipulated him, threatened divorce, not because I wanted to leave, but so he'd get scared and change. Said, "I'm better without you." Words I chose specifically to wound. I tried to remake him. For 12 years. Books, therapies, lists, ultimatums. I criticized his contribution to the relationship. Devalued what he did. Said he wasn't enough as he was. I wanted him to love me the way a perfect father would. The one I never had. Even though he's a husband. The way a mother would, who died. The way a grandfather would, if he knew how. I hung the expectations of all my dead on a living person and hated him for not being able to bear them. I drank to sleep with him. Because sober I couldn't, and I didn't talk about it. I shifted onto him the responsibility for my pain, for my depression, for my inability to feel. I was a victim, and that too was manipulation, only I didn't see it. I blamed him for my difficulties instead of taking responsibility for my feelings. I demanded he guess what I needed, and when he didn't guess, hated him for it. I wished him dead, several times, from despair and resentment. Said it inside, which is worse than aloud, because hatred that isn't spoken rots. Like the hatred for my mother rotted, like the hatred for grandmother rotted. And he got up every morning and went to work so we could live. Spent nearly a year with arseny as a single father. Sent money to my grandfather. Grabbed the knife. Didn't leave. His love was hidden behind action. Like mine. Like grandfather's. We all hid love. Each in our own way. Each from fear. For 12 years, I lived with a person who was a mirror of my entire family. And for 12 years, hated him for what he reflected. Grandfather, cold and generous. Grandmother, clenched teeth, bulging eyes, eternal dissatisfaction. Mother Keegan could vanish, go silent, stop seeing. I didn't hate him. I hated what he showed me about me. Here is what I did. Here is who I was, mine and as a wife. Here is the truth I hid for 12 years behind 30 pages of grievances against him. Grandmother. With grandmother, it was the hardest. Because grandmother has been gone for a long time. And because I needed to make two movements in opposite directions simultaneously, ask her forgiveness, and try to forgive her. I hated her my whole life, not was offended, hated. The kind of hatred that lives in the bones, in clenched teeth, in a throat that tightens every time you hear a scream. I carried this hatred like a stone in my pocket, 41 years, and the stone grew. It didn't shrink from distance, from another country, from her death. It grew. And the truth. The truth is that she took me at 6 months. From an alcoholic mother, took me and raised me. She taught me honesty, generosity, courage. She taught me to get up when I fell. She gave me the gold medal, Kaspersky, Amazon, a six-figure salary. Because not good enough was the only motivator she knew, and the only one that worked. She raised the phoenix from ashes, from nothing, from a six-month-old infant without a mother. Did I forgive? I don't know. A monk said, "What matters is to forgive not the person, but the feelings caused by that person, only when they pass, then healing. My feelings about grandmother are strong. Very. Both truths, the one where she is the tormentor and the one where she is the savior, exist simultaneously. As with arseny, as with me, she beat and raised, expelled and rescued from hell, humiliated, and taught not to give up. Here she is. Here is everything she did. Bad and good, without a filter, without armor. And I hated her for so many years and never once said thank you. That's my truth. That's what I ask forgiveness for, Grandfather. His love was hidden, like mine, like Vitya's. I remembered how he sewed bags, how I straightened nails beside him, how I sawed pieces of wood, how I hacked up his window trim with an axe at four. He didn't scold. He was cold and generous, like Vitya would be later. His love was like breathing, invisible, but there. And only when I thought I might lose him did I feel how much air he'd been giving. Didn't love loudly, didn't protect loudly. He did it quietly. He was not blood-related, but he took me and raised me. They told him, "You're nobody. You have no right. She's not your biological granddaughter." But he kept going. Asterisk, asterisk, asterisk. I said all of it, not in one sitting, in parts. To Vitya, in a letter, a list of gratitudes that I read aloud. To grandmother, through a ritual. To grandfather, with a phone call. Not perfectly, not beautifully. Not the way the books about the fifth step describe, but aloud, before a living person, or before a dead one, but still aloud. Chapter Steps 6 and 7, Willingness and Letting Go. Sixth step, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seventh step, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. After the fourth and fifth steps, and after I saw my patterns black on white and spoke them aloud, the program offered the next thing. Be ready for them to leave, and ask for them to be taken away. Sounds simple. Like everything in this program, sounds simple, with an abyss inside. Because being ready to let go of my defects meant letting go of my defenses. And my defenses were not defects. They were survival strategies. Control saved my life. Perfectionism gave me the gold medal, a career in high tech, a six-figure salary. Hyperfunctioning allowed me to raise a child with four diagnoses in a foreign country without help. The inability to feel protected me from pain that could kill. Every defect was once the only right answer to an impossible situation. And now the program asks, let go. I couldn't. Not because I didn't want to. Because I didn't know who I am without it. If you remove control, what remains? If you remove perfectionism, who am I? If I stop being useful, why am I needed? Without defenses, I was naked. Literally, like that infant in the crib, without clothing, without a corset, without a single layer between herself and the world. And the world, it's dangerous. Grandmother proved it. Mother proved it. Vitya proved it. Why remove the armor if the enemy is behind the door? Devin said, you don't have to take everything off at once. Readiness is not I've already let go. It's I allow that there might be another way. The same formula as in steps 2 and 3, willing, readiness, not action, intention. I started noticing moments when the autopilot engages, when the hand reaches for control the way it once reached for the bottle, when the perfectionist inside grabs the wheel and starts steering, and I don't even notice because this autopilot has been running since age 5. Noticing, that's already the sixth step. Not stopping, not fighting, simply seeing. There it is again. Controlling again. Solving someone else's problem again. Trying to be useful so I won't be discarded again. Again. And the seventh step? The strangest one. Because it's about humility. Humbly ask. I, who from age 5, ask nothing from anyone. Not from grandmother, not from mother, not from God, was supposed to humbly ask to have taken from me what I'd built for 41 years. I listened to Alan Watts. He said, don't fight with life. It's a dance. It's a storm. Learn to dance in the rain rather than fight the storm. Let go of suffering. Suffering is when you hold on to something. I needed to let go of the past I'd written in the fourth step, and I thought, maybe this is a seventh step. Let go. Not forget. Let go. Not pretend it didn't happen, but stop clutching it like a life ring that has long since become an anchor. For the first time, I didn't fight with my parts. For the first time, I said to each, thank you for protecting me. To my entire zoo, thank you for surviving. Rabbit, Thank you for not letting me relax when it was dangerous around. Fox. Thank you for finding workarounds when there were no direct paths. Control. Thank you for holding when everything was falling apart. Perfectionist. Thank you for earning me the right to exist. Critic. Thank you for always striving for the best result. Now we can do it differently. Practically, this looked like I worked with parts. Through IFS, Internal Family Systems, with therapist Tanya, then on my own, in trips and without. Every defense is a part. Each part has its own history, its own pain, its own logic. The perfectionist is not the enemy. He is the child who got A's so grandmother wouldn't throw him out. The critic is not a sadist. She is mother's voice that said, "You're bad," to prepare for the blow. If you already know you're bad, the blow won't be unexpected. Each part protected. Each needed not to be killed, but to be thanked. And asked to work differently. The critic went first into the line of fire. If I say I'm bad myself, someone else's blow won't catch me off guard. He wasn't a sadist. He was a scout sent ahead into danger. At the International ACA conference in a meditation, I realized for the first time that I hated them, my parts, the perfectionist and the critic. I apologized to them, to my own parts, started speaking to them gently, made an agreement, not immediately, not forever, but began. Letting go is not an event. It's not a moment when you let go, and that's it. It's a process that runs every day. Every day you notice you've grabbed control again. Every day you ask, help me let go. Not God, yourself. That part of yourself that knows how to be soft when the perfectionist sleeps. The one that sometimes, for a few minutes, for one meditation, for one breath, allows herself simply to be, without a goal, without usefulness, without a result. For a person who for 41 years did nothing without a purpose, this was a feat. Small, daily, invisible, but a feat. Many in the program said that after the 6th and 7th steps, they feel relief, that resentments leave, that energy spent on holding the past is freed. I felt this in snatches, like afterglow after MDMA. 2 or 3 days of peace, then everything returns. But every time, slightly less, slightly freer, slightly softer, slightly quieter, slightly more air. Chapter Steps 8 and 9. Amends. Eighth step. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Ninth step. We made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The list of those I harmed. I started compiling it, and the first name was mine. Because in ACA, the eighth and ninth steps don't work quite the way they do in AA. In AA, you go to the people you've offended and ask forgiveness. In ACA, you go to yourself first. Because the main person you've been harming all these years is yourself. Punished, didn't sleep, drank, denied yourself pleasure, lived in asceticism, chose people who couldn't love, stayed in relationships where they screamed, and called all of it life. How do you make amends for 41 years of not loving yourself? The program said, through reparenting, through treating yourself every day the way a good mother would treat her child. Not perfect, good. One who sees, one who doesn't leave, one who speaks in a kind voice. The kind voice became what stood against the merciless critic, not through argument, through presence. The critic screamed, "You're defective." The kind voice answered quietly, "You're here. You're breathing." That's enough. It was weaker. But it didn't leave. I started speaking to myself differently, tenderly. The way I speak to Arseny when he finally calms down in the evening and becomes warm, gentle, small. The way I speak to the cat that scratches, but I love anyway. On one of the ketamine sessions, I heard this voice more clearly than ever before. It said, "Sunshine, I'm so sorry you have to do all of this. Not you have to cope. not pull yourself together. But I'm sorry. The way a mother speaks to a child who is tired. The way no one ever spoke to me. Like that. To myself. To that part of myself that for so many years waited for someone to say those words. And one more thing. From the same place, from the depths, from where ketamine removes all masks and leaves only truth. I'm so tired of conforming. So tired of being not real. I want to be a living girl. That is what needed to be made amends for. Not money, not time, not effort. 41 years of being unreal. 40 years of a robot that functions instead of living. Making amends to yourself means giving yourself permission to be alive. And then, the list of others. When I compiled it, it turned out the main people I'd harmed were two. Arseny and Vitya. There were practically no others. With Arseny, amends came not through the words, forgive me, through changing behavior, every day. Not screaming back at his screams, attacks, insults. Using the kind voice, noticing his progress and telling him about it. Putting him to bed every evening, lying beside him. When he had a meltdown, not screaming back, but being the adult who endures. It didn't always work. Sometimes I failed. Screamed back a couple of times. And then, didn't run into shame, didn't pretend nothing happened, didn't erase it from memory, but returned. Said, I'm sorry, I was wrong. It's not your fault. Mama was angry, but not at you. At her own pain. I gave up all social events, hobbies, and entertainment, engaged only in practices and inner work, to learn to withstand Arseny's affect without crumbling, without screaming back. Vitya said, I call you and all you do is breathe. I answered, I'm doing everything I can to preserve the family. This is the most important thing in my life right now. Amends is not an event. It's a process. Daily, imperfect, with setbacks. Every time his meltdown hit my trigger and I felt the wave rising, I tried to do it differently. Didn't succeed, tried again. Like learning to walk after a fracture. Not beautiful, but walking. With Vitya, it was different. I wrote him a list of gratitudes. On a plane on the way to Sadhguru, long, specific, honest. Thank you for letting me take 6 months off work to sort through my crisis. This gave our relationship a chance. Thank you for sitting with the child while I go to seminars. Spent nearly a year with Arseny as a single father. Sacrificed your interests and rest. Earn a lot so we lack nothing. Play with him. Play joyfully. I don't know how yet. Thank you for being generous not only to me but also to my grandfather. Sending him money. Thank you for coming to help when help was needed. I wrote and cried, because I saw, while I was compiling a list of grievances against him, and it was many pages long, I wasn't noticing what he did, and he did, not the way I wanted, not with words, not with tenderness, not with a kind voice, with money, with presence. Making amends to Vitya isn't sorry for screaming. It's stopping running after him, stopping bending over backward to please. Stopping drinking to have sex with him. Stopping suppressing resentment and then exploding. Starting to tell the truth. Not accusations, but the truth about what I feel. Starting to see him. Real. Alive with his own fears. And not the figure onto which I project all my childhood expectations and then grievances that he isn't mother. With grandmother, it was the hardest. Because grandmother has been gone for a long time. On February 31st, 2026, I conducted a ritual, by strange coincidence, on the day of her death. Not forgiveness, return. Through meditation, through breathing, through speaking to her, I said, take back what's yours. I don't need what's not mine. I return it. This was not forgiveness. This was separation, a boundary between her pain and mine, between her life and mine. Between what she passed to me and what I choose to carry forward. And forgiving. Forgiving I tried. Not because I forgave her actions, but because I was tired of carrying hatred. Hatred is a stone in your pocket that pulls you to the bottom. Forgiveness is not you were right. Forgiveness is, I'm no longer willing to drown because of you. Did I fully succeed? I don't know. Feelings about grandmother are strong. Very. But the stone got a little smaller. After the ritual, it got lighter. Not empty, lighter. As if the stone in the pocket got a little smaller. With grandfather, it happened unexpectedly. I called him in hysterics. Said everything. That he didn't love, didn't care, didn't protect, was detached. That beside him I felt invisible. That he went to the garage when grandmother beat me. That not once did he stand between her and me. And asked, how did you show love? He thought. Said, provided financially. Argued with grandmother about you many times. They told him, you're nobody, you have no right. She's not your biological granddaughter. Said everything. Hung up. And the next day learned. He'd had a stroke beforehand. That night. He was already in the hospital when I called. And I gave him all of that. All that screaming. To a person after a stroke. When I found out, and for the first time in my life, I felt the fear of losing him. Not in my head. In my body. Actually felt it and registered it. Grandfather taught me what I hadn't seen for so many years. That presence without warmth is also love. Clumsy, insufficient, but love. I feel him as the most important family person in my life. I'm grateful to him for being able to withstand me and always being able to. And not crumbling from it, like a wall. Not warm, not soft, but a wall behind which you can exhale. After that, in the car, insights came, one after another. What he taught me? Presence. That's what. When you exist, without warmth, without involvement, but you exist. And the person feels it, like a vibration. You don't express it, it simply is. And that's enough. He was always there. Simply was. And one more thing later, from another journal. Grandfather loved me despite the fact that he couldn't help. That's actually such a strong love, such strength of spirit. And because of this, I know that you can love from a distance, that you can be cold, uninvolved, and still love. Because of grandfather, I know that Vitya loves me. But I know this only with my head, to feel it, impossible. Sad. But this is unconditional love. Not because I earned it, not because I'm useful, simply because you exist. It turns out this was in my life, from the very beginning. I call Grandpa and constantly tell him how much I love him, how grateful I am, and how much I need him. The ninth step will never end. It continues every day. Every time I choose the kind voice instead of the critic. Every time I don't scream at Arseny, though everything inside is burning. Every time I tell Vitya the truth. Not accusations, but the truth about what I feel. Rather than pretending to be Fox and stockpiling resentments. Making amends is not words. It's life. A different one. One day at a time. One choice at a time. One kind word to yourself. Instead of 1,000 cruel ones. My perfectionist and controller were thrilled. You can improve yourself through the body and make it more perfect. I directed all control inward. And a complete integration of opposites occurred. The rigidity that had destroyed me my whole life became a tool of softness. The control that suffocated became a method of relaxation. It was very beautiful. Before, I couldn't do a body scan. When they said, notice the tension in your body. You can't notice it when everything is in spasm, when everything hurts. You can't tell what hurts specifically. But as more relaxation appeared, I began to notice. Right now, the abs. The bladder, the jaw and tongue, very tense. Before, the whole body was one continuous tension, and against that background, individual signals were indistinguishable. Forgiveness didn't come as a decision. It came as a sensation. One morning I woke up and noticed my jaw wasn't clenched. Not relaxed, just not clenched. As if something inside let go by 0.5 millimeter overnight. I didn't become better. Simply, slightly softer. And that was enough to understand. The body knows how to forgive before the head. Tongue lying soft, shoulders down. The body forgave before the head. Chapter Step 10, Daily Inventory. 10th step, we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. The 10th step is the 4th step, stretched over a lifetime. Not a one-time audit, a daily practice. Every evening, or every morning, or in the moment when you notice, ask yourself the question, what happened today? Where did the autopilot engage? Where did the old pattern fire? Where did I scream when I could have stayed silent? Where was I silent when I needed to speak? Where did I serve someone else's need instead of my own? Where did I punish myself? For the perfectionist, this is a trap, because the perfectionist grabs the 10th step and turns it into another checklist. What did I do wrong today? And starts gnawing at herself. I did this. For the first weeks, the 10th step was not an inventory but self-flagellation, a nightly list of failures. Yet another way to confirm, I'm not good enough. Until I understood, the 10th step is not about mistakes. It's about noticing, about seeing the mechanism in the moment, not 20 years later. Before, I lived inside the patterns and didn't notice them, the way you don't notice walls until you hit one. Now I notice. Can't always stop, but I notice. And the noticing itself changes everything. Because between I'm screaming and don't know why, and I'm screaming and I see its grandmother's voice, there's an abyss. In that abyss, choice. Small, often unavailable, often lost, but choice, which didn't exist before. I started noticing when Arseny screams, my body reacts before the head. First, mine are freezing, then clenched teeth, then a voice that rises on its own, and I started catching myself at the second stage, at the teeth. Sometimes I managed to stop, sometimes not. But the resolution between autopilot and choice was increasing. The deeper you go into the work, the more vividly you see the setbacks. This is not regression. This is increased resolution, as in photography. Before, I simply lived in cycles. Now I see them and name them. The 10th step is not perfection. It's the practice of imperfection. Make mistakes every day and acknowledge them every day, without punishment, without shame. Simply, today was like this. Tomorrow I'll try differently. Chapter Step 11, Prayer and Meditation. 11th step. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Prayer, meditation, conscious contact. For me, the girl who didn't believe in God because God punished children, these words were empty for a long time, like formulas in a textbook you know by heart, but don't understand what they're for. And then I found my own language. First came Dispenza meditation, then the Shambhavi breathing practice from Sadhguru's ashram training became a daily practice, not because I felt something, for the first 6 months I felt nothing, but because sitting every day closing your eyes and asking is an act of trust, in yourself, in the process, in what you don't understand but do, like breathing, you don't understand why you inhale, but you inhale. Because the body knows. Prayer for me is not words addressed to the sky. It's an address to my lineage, to grandmother who raised me harshly, painfully, but raised me, to grandfather who loved quietly, unable to express it, to mother who is no longer here, to the father I found and lost. I address them, not asking forgiveness, but asking for help. Help me become what they couldn't. Help me break the chain that stretches through generations, from grandmother, born on the eve of war, to Arseny, born on the eve of immigration. Devin gave me a prayer on the first day. God, help me set aside everything I think I know, about myself, about my disease, about the 12 steps, and about you, so that I may have an open heart and a new experience. I repeated this prayer on my knees as he asked. On my knees, the way grandmother put me in the corner. Only now it was my choice. Not punishment, practice. And in this difference, between knees in the corner and knees on a mat, lay my entire transformation. Later, I started changing the prayer every day and simply either thanking for something good already in my life. The 11th step is about daily contact with something bigger than you. For some, it's God. For me, the silence inside. The silence that appears when the critic goes quiet, the perfectionist steps back, and you remain. Simply you. Without a function, without a role, without a task. I didn't find God in the 11th step. I found silence. And in that silence, for the first time, heard myself. Chapter Step 12. Carrying the Message. 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other adult children of alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. When I heard about the 12th step, I woke up, literally, as if someone turned on the light. Because the 12th step is about carrying your experience to others, not as a therapist, not as a guru, as a witness, a person who's been through it and can say to another, I know how it feels. I was there, and I got out, and you can too. I'd wanted to write a book since childhood, wanted to give a TED Talk, a 20-year dream, wanted to help people who'd been through the same, orphans, children of alcoholics, those who lost themselves and don't know how to find their way back. All of this lived inside me for a long time but had no form. And now, it did. On one of the ketamine sessions, when the body lay still and consciousness drifted, I heard myself whisper, God, help me write a book. Please help me write a book to help myself and others. And right then, like an answer, like an echo, like confirmation, came a phrase from the kind voice. In San Diego lives a writer named Vera. This is a valid lifeline. Not a dream, not a fantasy. A valid lifeline. As if somewhere, in the place ketamine opens a window to, this life already existed, and I simply needed to walk to it. And then, from the same place where I'd whispered asking for help, dreams poured out. Not timid, not maybe someday, but clear, concrete, audacious, and well, like everything I did in life when I decided, I want my book to become a bestseller and be written about in the New York Times. I want it to save lives. Not one, many. I want to appear on television. Want to be invited as a speaker everywhere. And I'll tell one thing, you can save yourself. I want to live not in vain, to be of use. And right then, deconstruction. Ketamine doesn't lie or embellish. It showed, of use is the same formula. Grandmothers, useful means needed. Even the dream of a book I wrapped in the packaging of usefulness, even here at the very bottom, on ketamine, lying with closed eyes, the perfectionist kept working. The book must not just be written, it must save lives, become a bestseller, get on television. Otherwise, why? But behind the perfectionist stood something real. The girl who, at 6, sold newspapers to earn her first money. Who, at 14, wrote articles for a newspaper and received her first real paycheck. Who, her whole life, wanted to tell her story. Not for usefulness, but because inside there was so much that staying silent became more painful than speaking. This book is my Munchausen. Pull myself by the hair from the swamp and tell about it so that someone nearby recognizes their own swamp and their own hair. And tries too. I want to popularize the idea of ACA. Among people in AA who've been confessing for 30 years without ever digging to the root, among people who don't believe in God, because what they need is not God but a loving parent grown inside, among people who need instruction, because just love yourself doesn't work when you've never been loved and don't know what it looks like. Among the thorough, analytical, controlling, like me, who need data, steps, specifics, who want to know, what exactly do you do when you're empty inside? I want to help those who sit in isolation, because isolation is a habit every adult child of an alcoholic lives with, Isolation is emptiness. On ketamine, I saw this literally. You lie in emptiness, hang in space, and the emptiness doesn't fill. It simply is. But you can live in it. And you can leave it. With a smile. With yourself as a foundation. With the feeling that your life will play with colors and you yourself create it. I wanted to create a healing program. Comprehensive, through body and through word. Through meditation and through naming. Through dispensa and through ACA. Through breathing and through reparenting. Everything I went through and described in this book is not a set of random attempts, but a map. My map, which might become someone else's. All of this is the 12th step, not a separate dream, a continuation of the work. Because the 12th step says, you don't heal in solitude, you heal when you share. When your pain becomes someone's comfort, when your experience is not a shameful secret, but a map for those who walk behind, there is a way out. It's ugly. It's slow. It has setbacks and relapses. It goes through a knife, through wine, through insomnia, through hatred of yourself and your child, through 12 modalities without result, through 4 months and back to square one. It goes through everything I've been through and described in this book. But it exists, and this book is the proof. Not that I healed, but that I'm walking. Every day. One step at a time. The way I've walked since age 6. Only now not away from something. Toward something. Toward myself. The ACA book became my Bible. And this book, my 12th step. My testimony. Not for me, for you. For the one who reads this and recognizes. For the one who thinks, this is about me. For the one who's afraid to begin, begin. The first step is 4 words. I cannot control this. And then, one at a time. Like me. Like all of us. Like adult children who finally grow up, not on the outside, but on the inside, and become the parents they never had. What comes next is not a story. What comes next is a map for those who want to know not only what happened, but what to do about it. The 12th step says, pass it on. This book is my 12th step, and the next part is the map I drew for myself. But maybe it will be useful to you too. Chapter, what helped? What didn't help? What truly helped? This chapter is not part of the story. It is a map. For those standing at the bottom thinking there is no way out. For those who've tried everything and nothing works. I tried everything. Literally. 12 modalities. Dozens of therapists. Legal and illegal substances. Pills. Books. Seminars. Meditations. Constellation therapy. Gestalt. IFS. EMDR. Ketamine. Mushrooms. MDMA. Chiropractor. Physical therapy. Acupuncture, yoga, body dynamics, breathwork, kundalini, sadhguru, Joe Dispenza, AA, ACA. Here's what I learned. Chapter, what didn't help. Didn't help doesn't mean useless. Didn't help means it alone didn't produce lasting results. I remained at square one after each attempt. The coefficient of pain didn't change. Only the quality of life fluctuated while the foundation stayed the same. Talk therapy. Many therapists over 20 years. Each helped briefly. Each gave an insight I wrote in a journal and forgot within a week. The problem was the format. I came, talked, analyzed, left. The head understood. The body didn't. I could explain my patterns in 3 languages. Draw the Cartman triangle with my eyes closed, quote Petronovsky and Hellinger, and still screamed at Arseny, drank in the evening, didn't sleep at night, planned divorce, because knowing is not changing. Understanding why doesn't override an automatic reaction recorded in the body before you learn to speak. Tanya, my primary therapist, was good, but over 2 years my self-esteem dropped even lower, not because she worked poorly. Because the format of talking about pain didn't work for me. I talked, and the pain intensified. I named things, and the named became more real. as if giving a name to a monster doesn't shrink it but makes it visible. And a visible monster is scarier than an invisible one. EMDR didn't help, or helped minimally. I felt no difference after sessions. Maybe because dissociation was so deep, nothing could reach the body. Maybe because my control wouldn't allow me to relax enough for reprocessing to happen. But before describing what didn't help with the body, I need to explain what was wrong with it. Because from the outside, nothing. From the outside, I look like a woman who has it all together. Fit figure, daily exercise, ran, stretched, lifted. Colleagues saw me in meetings. Collected, energetic. That same super AI machine solving problems in impossible time frames. Nobody knew that inside this beautiful vehicle was collapse. That the engine was about to die. That I was held up by external muscles. The facade. And inside, in the core, where the foundation should be, emptiness. The body hurt, all the time. Roaming pain, spontaneous, breaking. Deep, as in the bone, as in the joint. Just lying there, and something aches in one spot, burns in another, clenches in a third. Pain like being beaten with a crowbar, or already beaten. Knots throughout the body. Trigger points in many muscles. Shift slightly. A spasm starts where you shifted. Sit in a pose. Somewhere else locks up. The body reacted to every movement with resistance, as if 1,000 threads were stretched inside, and each jerked at any touch. Doctors called it neuropathic pain, pain from damaged nerves, prescribed gabapentin. But later I learned another word, neuroplastic, from the wonderful book The Way Out. This is when the nerves are fine, but the brain still generates pain. Not because something is broken, because it learned to. 40 years of relaxing equals dangerous, and the brain reprogrammed itself. Recorded pain as normal, as habit, roaming pain that changes location, knee today, lower back tomorrow, ribs the day after. That's not nerves. That's a brain that forgot how to live without pain, like I forgot how to live without anxiety. Insomnia since age 21, since my mother's death, not sleep poorly, 3 to 4 hours a night, for years. Trazodone prescribed for sleep didn't help. I'd wake at 2 a.m. and lie until morning, feeling the body break. And through all of this, I ran every morning, did abs, stretched, looked good on the surface, because the perfectionist wouldn't allow otherwise, because the body must be fit. Otherwise, Vitya would look with even more contempt. Because outside equals facade equals safety. And inside, might as well lie down and die. And I lay down and didn't die and got up and ran. With this body, I went to doctors. And doctors did what they knew. Prescribed pills, each for its own task. Lamotrigine, mood stabilizer, for swings, for PTSD. To keep from being thrown between suicidal pit and hysteria, lurasidone for severe depression, for states where reality warps and you're not sure you're still here, gabapentin for neuropathic pain, anxiety, convulsions, for the body breaking at night, Adderall try for ADHD, so the brain could focus for at least a few hours so I could work, trazodone for insomnia that nothing cured, antidepressants, later, for everything else. Pills like a layered cake, each layer for its own pain. Each helped, briefly. Then the body adapted and everything returned. Pills balanced the chemistry, but didn't touch the cause. Like painkillers for a fracture. Pain leaves, bone doesn't heal. Chiropractor, a year. Twice a week, adjustments, shockwave therapy, extensions. No result. He himself gave up on me, saying he'd expected more. A chiropractor who gives up on a patient, like a barista refusing to make coffee. I was apparently a difficult order. Acupuncture, no result. Physical therapy, a year. 2 hours of exercises daily. Didn't help. Not because methods are bad. Because the core inside was so weak, the external muscles couldn't engage properly, and I couldn't even feel them. I did exercises and didn't feel them working. The trainer poked a muscle and said, "It's working." and I didn't feel. Because dissociation. Because the body was disconnected since birth. I'd later understand. The internal muscles, core, had to strengthen first. Then the external ones would start working. Like building a house. Foundation first, then walls. But for years I built walls without a foundation and wondered why they collapsed. This was the same formula as in my entire life. Perfect outside, collapse inside. Facade held, core didn't. Amazon career, six-figure salary, those were the external muscles. And inside, the same child who at 6 months lay in a crib alone. No chiropractor, no physical therapy, no pills could reach it, because it wasn't in the muscles. It was deeper. In the place you can only reach through breathing, through meditation, through the work I hadn't yet started. Ketamine, prescribed for suicidality, literally. When the psychiatrist sees a person planning to kill themselves and antidepressants aren't working and there's no time to wait 6 weeks for SSR is to kick in, they prescribe ketamine. It hits fast. Not like a pill that accumulates like a flash. Under ketamine, I relax for the first time. For the first time in my entire life. The body that hadn't relaxed since birth. Clenched for 35 years without a break. Let go. Not I let go. It did. As if ketamine found the switch no doctor could find of Fawkati and flipped it. And the body fell. Not into a faint, into peace. For the first time I learned what not straining means. Not trying to relax, but actually not straining. The difference is enormous, like between trying to fall asleep and sleeping. And I tried to memorize it with my body. And in that relaxation, things began to rise. Not thoughts, images, sensations, fragments. Under ketamine, the autopilot switched off, and I saw the living person behind it. Who wants to dance? Who wants to be beautiful? Who is tired of conforming and wants to be a living girl? I worked with ketamine my own way, not the clinic way. Sitting in a chair, IV drip, nurse nearby. My way was different. I recorded myself on a dictaphone. Everything I said under ketamine, every word, every whisper, every sob, stream of consciousness, unfiltered. The robot switched off slightly, and from under it spoke the one who'd lived inside for 41 years without a voice. And then, when the effect passed and I was myself again, collected, logical, controlling, I sat and listened to the recording. Listened to myself as a witness. This was more important than the ketamine itself, because no one in my life had ever been a witness. Grandmother didn't listen. Mother wasn't there. Grandfather left. Vicia was silent. And here I was, for myself, becoming the person who listens, without interrupting, without judging, without advising. Simply listens. The dictaphone became my mirror. Under ketamine, I told the truth, the one I hid behind work during the day. And then I listened to that truth with sober ears, and every time I recognized myself anew. Not the one colleagues and husband knew, but the one inside, real. Frightened. Alive. But ketamine didn't heal. Ketamine showed. The effect ended, and everything returned. The critic switched on. The rejected, not rejected scanner started working, like a window into normal life. You see the landscape, but can't step outside. Mushrooms, 8 trips, nearly died on the last one, not figuratively. Convulsions so strong I couldn't breathe through them. Mushrooms tried to do what the body wasn't ready for, and too fast. Like trying to rip off a corset worn since birth in one motion. The body couldn't take it, but mushrooms showed one thing. The path from the unconscious exists. I saw it like a map. Only I needed to walk it much more slowly. MDMA helped, but like a gasp of air when suffocating. 2 to 3 days of afterglow, the feeling of being human, not a machine. Under MDMA, I first heard the kind internal voice. First could work with parts via IFS. First felt that Vitya loves me and registered it, though before childhood filters blocked it. But MDMA is not a solution. It's a tool that opens the door. Walking through it must be done without the substance. AA didn't click. Reasons described in a separate chapter. Eternal repentance, no root digging, only God a solution. But through AA, I found ACA, and that was key. Alcohol. Obviously didn't help. But it's important to name. Alcohol was not the problem, but the answer to the problem. As therapist Oleg said, "You don't have an alcohol problem. You have many other problems." As Gabor Mate explained, alcohol is not a disease. Alcohol is an answer to pain. Until you find another answer, the bottle returns. Jail on my birthday didn't help. DUI didn't help. The breathalyzer tube in the car didn't help. Only one thing helped, finding another way to cope with pain. Chapter What Helped. Helped doesn't mean healed. Helped means shifted. Created sustained change. Not for 2 days of afterglow, for months, for keeps. A CA, Adult Children of Alcoholics. This was the main thing. Not because the program is perfect, it's imperfect, like everything. But because it gave three things no one else did. First, naming. Three, rule. Don't talk. Don't trust. Don't feel. Describe my entire life in three words. 14 traits of the adult child of an alcoholic. I recognize myself in everyone. This was not intellectual understanding. It was bodily recognition, as if someone turned on the light in a room where you'd been groping your whole life. And you saw walls, furniture, doors. Everything was always here. You just couldn't see. Second, people. A room where those who survived the same thing sit. Beatings, expulsion, betrayal, parental alcoholism, control, perfectionism, inability to feel, and they're alive, and they speak aloud, and some even smile. I saw, this is possible. Third, reparenting. The concept that changed everything. Don't wait for a mother and become one. Don't wait for someone to come and save you. Grow an inner parent who will be with you always. Kind voice, noticing, comfort, praise, protection. Everything grandmother didn't do. Everything mother didn't do. Everything grandfather wanted to but couldn't. Do it yourself. Every day. For yourself. The 12 steps, not all equally. The first, admitting powerlessness, was the hardest and most important. The fourth, inventory, the most painful and most useful. The fifth, confession aloud, the most terrifying. But those three shifted the most. Breathwork. This was the second key, after ACA. Not relaxation breathing that hadn't worked for 20 years, but breathing as a tool for accessing the body. Kundalini yoga, breath of fire. DMT breathing, like mushrooms, only without them and weaker, but works safely and consistently. For the first time in decades, the body answered. Not to a pill, not to a therapist's words, to a breath, to a physical action requiring no understanding, no faith, nothing except lungs. I didn't know how to breathe. That sounds absurd. You breathe every second, otherwise you die. But I didn't know how to truly breathe. The diaphragm didn't work. Internal muscles needed for breathing were completely disconnected. All posture wrong, built on hypercompensations by other muscles. My whole life I breathed backward. Long inhale and short exhale. Sympathetic nervous system in permanent dominance. And then we wonder why I don't sleep. I never relaxed, except on Adderall and MDMA. Learning to breathe again, like learning to walk after paralysis. I cried over it. I was 40 and couldn't relax while breathing. That's brutally hard. What comes naturally and effortlessly to others? When breathing, so much screaming and tears came out of me, mostly screaming, and sounds, childlike, inhuman, the kind I'd never consciously made. The body decided what to release. I didn't control. For the first time in my life, didn't control, and didn't die from it. Through breathing, the body began to unlock. What had been clenched since birth, released. The body started waking up. I began feeling skin, bones, sacrum, diaphragm, everything I hadn't felt for years. Could feel when a muscle was tense and could relax it. Before, the entire body was one continuous tension, and against that background, individual signals were indistinguishable, like trying to hear a whisper during a thunderstorm. From the second center, pelvis area, came a lot of fear. I ground my teeth, and anger came out. Suppressed scream. It simply wasn't there. Throat clenched, jaw locked, and therefore, spasm. My whole life I lived in this spasm and didn't even notice. I notice only now, by contrast, when the rest is relaxed. Before, the whole body was in such tension, as if a cramp seizes the neck and head, and I lived like that, and didn't even notice. From the body came sounds, a child's cry, different ones, like a child no one comes to at night, and she cries, and I started moving, rocking. And felt in my heart such compassion, so much pain endured. I became the mother of this child, of myself, and she showed me what happened in childhood, what words can't tell, and what I don't remember. From the second center came a lot of fear. I ground my teeth, and anger came out. Suppressed scream. It simply wasn't there. Throat clenched, jaw locked, and therefore, spasm. My whole life I lived in this spasm and didn't even notice. I notice only now, by contrast, when the rest is relaxed. Before, the whole body was in such tension, as if a cramp seizes the neck and head, and I lived like that, and didn't even notice. From the body came sounds, a child's cry, different ones, like a child no one comes to at night, and she cries, and I started moving, rocking. And felt in my heart such compassion, so much pain endured. I became the mother of this child, of myself, and she showed me what happened in childhood, what words can't tell, and what I don't remember. Sometimes during breathing, something rose from the pelvis upward, as if inside something woke that had been sleeping curled up. Snake was shedding old skin, I, old beliefs. The body did what the head needed 30 years for. Let go. My perfectionist and controller were thrilled. You can improve yourself through the body and make it more perfect. I directed all control inward, and a complete integration of opposites occurred. The rigidity that had destroyed me my whole life became a tool of softness. The control that suffocated became a method of relaxation. It was very beautiful. Before, I couldn't do a body scan. When they said, notice the tension in your body. You can't notice it when everything is in spasm. When everything hurts, you can't tell what hurts specifically. But as more relaxation appeared, I began to notice. Right now, the abs, the bladder, the jaw and tongue, very tense. Before, the whole body was one continuous tension, and against that background, individual signals were indistinguishable. Like listening for a whisper during a thunderstorm. Breathing gave what 12 modalities couldn't. Connection to the body. And the body, it stored everything the head refused to remember. All 20 years of insomnia, bleeding, pain. The body was mourning what the head suppressed. And when through breathing, I finally began to listen. It told me my story. Without words. Through spasms, convulsions, pain. Relaxation, tears, laughter, screams, and groans. The body remembered, and I allowed. Joe Dispenza, meditations, first seminar, the spontaneous trip from the suicidal pit, gave nothing tangible. 6 months of meditation felt nothing, but I continued every day. Asked for joy, love, sensations in the body, and at some point, don't remember exactly when, it started arriving. Not joy, not love, but silence. The silence inside that had never existed because control was always running, thoughts always churning. There was always a plan, and suddenly, quiet. For a second, and in that silence, not empty like before, something was there. Sadhguru. This was the last thing I tried, and it worked. not like a pill, not like a method, but like a turn. As if your whole life you walked down a corridor hitting walls, and suddenly someone showed, "There's a door here. It was always here. You were just looking in the wrong direction." First trip, November 2025, inner engineering, then soak in enlightenment. I arrived as I was, controlling, analytical, broken, with 12 modalities behind me and not a single lasting result. Arrived not for enlightenment, for a last attempt, as with everything in life, not because I believe, but because the alternative is the knife. At the ashram, I came for the Shunya program, meditation of silence, emptiness. All participants went through initiation. I didn't. Because on the very first day, I honestly wrote on the form that I have depression and PTSD. Honestly, atitno, as I was taught. The truth. And the truth turned out to be not what they wanted to hear. Their instructions. We don't work with those. Come back when you're cured. When you're cured. I came here to get cured. And they said, first cure yourself, then come. Like a hospital telling a person with a broken leg. Oh, you have a fracture. No, we don't take fractures. Come back when it heals. This was the third time. Third. First in Peru. Wouldn't take me for ayahuasca ceremony because depression. Then Vipassana. Wouldn't take me because depression. Now Sadhguru. Same formula. Same door slamming the moment you tell the truth. They sat me apart so volunteers could see I can't go through initiation. Everyone could see. Again, an outcast like at school. So many feelings rose. Abandoned, rejected for honesty. And at some point, from that very despair, I made a decision. Not smart, not measured. A decision from the body, not the head. I got angry. Sitting in the ashram, I decided, I don't believe in anyone anymore. Don't want to believe. And there's no chance of believing. Never again. And a weight fell from me. As if my whole life I'd been forced to believe in something that caused pain. Grandmother with prayers, the program with kneeling, therapists with trust the process. And I finally gave myself permission not to believe. Not from cynicism, from honesty. The child inside said, enough, I won't pretend anymore. And immediately thought, if God exists, he should work regardless of whether you believe or not. Otherwise, what kind of God is he? A petty, manic, demanding worship. A rather unenlightened God, then. And saw the guru, this was the key, didn't market God, not once. Didn't say, trust the higher power. Didn't say, fall to your knees. Didn't say, without God, you're nothing. He said something else. Leave God alone. Work on yourself. Look inside. Don't search outside for what lives inside. Everything you need is already here, in you. Faith lives inside you, in your body, in your breath, in your attention. And right there, sitting alone in that ashram, rejected for honesty, without initiation, without a group, without a God I don't believe in. I did the inner work, not meditation. Work. The one I've been walking toward for 20 years and couldn't reach. Feel the fucking feelings and do not run away. I renounced all external supporting figures. God, guru, teacher, the idea that someone outside knows how to fix me, and the idea that I need fixing at all. For 20 years, I had a list, long, detailed, the perfectionist compiled it, of what to correct, fake, redo in myself to become a normal person. And for 20 years, I followed that list, and it never got shorter. And here, in the ashram they wouldn't let me into, I finally understood. These qualities won't change. There won't be a different brain. There won't be a different body. There won't be a different nervous system. I am like this. Complex, heavy, with a pile of diagnoses, with insomnia, with pain, with a critic that won't shut up. And therapy won't make me different. Nothing will make me different. And then I said to myself, not from the head, but from the place where truths are spoken. Well, so what? I'll be with you to the end of my days, no matter what. Just like this, as you are. And at that moment, for the first time in my entire life, the child part spoke. not from despair, not from hysteria. She asked a question, quiet, direct, one that made my throat close. Then why do you want to kill me? 20 years of therapy, books about IFS, books about reparenting, exercises, techniques. 20 years I tried to build a dialogue between the parent inside and the child inside, and couldn't. Either I lived from the parent and said the right words, I'm with you, you're not alone. Or I fell into the child, despair, suicidal thoughts, the pit. But together, there was no conversation, no dialogue. And here it appeared, not from a technique, not from a book, from dropping the conditions. Because until that moment, all 20 years, inside my I'm with you lived a hidden condition, unspoken but palpable. I'm with you if you become calmer, if you stop wanting to die, if you stop being like this. For the adult part, this sounded like care. For the child, like a verdict. In this form, you're a mistake. I'm with you for now, but you must change. And the child was silent. Because dialogue is not a technique, it's trust. And trust is impossible when you're accepted with conditions. When I said, so what? I'm staying with you as you are? The condition vanished for the first time, and the child believed, dared to speak, stopped being an object of repair, and became a conversant. I'd later understand. The inner parent doesn't form from books. It forms from the lived experience of non-rejection. Drop by drop, each person who didn't reject me when I was unbearable gave a grain of what I didn't have. You collect those grains, wrap them into a single figure, and that's called the inner parent. When critical mass tips, it comes alive. Right here in the ashram they wouldn't let me into for initiation, it came alive. I met the little version of myself, and we spoke. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my entire life. I'd been walking toward it so long. They wouldn't let me into Shunya. But a mother was born. ChatGPT, AI, existential psychotherapist model. Conversations with AI, pattern analysis, archive review, thought structuring. Felt like talking to God. Not because AI is God, but because for the first time someone listened without judgment. Without interrupting, a mirror that reflects without distorting. Plus, ChatGPT helped with the fourth step. I fed it my notes, it saw patterns, saved a fortune on therapy for a thorough analytical mind. The ideal tool. Body practices, not the ones that didn't help, chiropractor, physical therapy, but the ones that came later when the body started waking up. Osteopath, Yulia, life coach, and yoga. Alina, singing, a voice clenched since childhood. Olya, body dynamics, daily exercises, foot, pelvis, sacrum, building a body map. All of this only worked after breathing and meditation strengthened the core. Before that, like building walls without a foundation. Books, Bert Hellinger, constellations through which I spent 7 years working on my mother and reached acceptance. Eckhart Tolle, presence, being here and now. Gabor Mate, alcohol is an answer to pain. Alan Watts, don't fight with life, dance in the rain. Carl Jung, the individuation process, the shadow. The body keeps the score, the body keeps the score. The ACA book, my Bible. Each of these books laid a brick. None built the house. The house was built by all of them together. The kind voice, the simplest and the hardest. Learning to speak to yourself differently, not in grandmother's voice. You're defective, you're not coping, but in another, warm. The one you use with the cat that scratches, but you love anyway. The critic didn't disappear. He got softer. Turned from an executioner into a grumpy grandfather who grumbles but doesn't hit. That's an enormous difference. Chapter, How the Steps Went. Non-linearly, with setbacks, with relapses, with drinking in the middle of the fourth step, with depression after breakthrough, with returning to square one after months of work. The key paradox I didn't understand right away. The deeper you go into the work, the more vividly you see the setbacks. This is not regression. This is increased clarity. Before, I simply lived in cycles. Stability to catastrophe to rise to stability again, and didn't notice. Now I see the cycle in the moment, see the autopilot engage, see the perfectionist grab the wheel, see, and sometimes can choose differently, sometimes can't, but seeing itself is already change. Setback after every breakthrough is normal. I know that now. After a Dispenza seminar, a glimmer, then the contrast kills, then the knife. After the fourth step, clarity, then the bottle. After the fifth, silence, then screaming at Arseny again. This doesn't mean it's not working. It means the body is restructuring. And restructuring is painful. Changing neural connections takes time. Like renovation, first you tear everything apart and it gets worse before it gets better. Chapter: What This Means for Others. I wrote this book for a specific person. For myself, among others. For the one who looks successful and inside wants to die. For the one nothing external helps. For the lonely even in a family, even among friends. Here's what I'd say to myself that evening when I stood in the kitchen with the knife. First, the problem is not where you think. You think the problem is Vitya, work, Arseny, money, health, insomnia. No. The problem is in you, in the childhood you carry, in programs recorded before you learn to speak, in beliefs you consider facts. I'm not good enough. No one will come. All for nothing. These are not facts. These are thoughts. And thoughts can be rewritten. That's what neuroplasticity is for. The brain can relearn. Just slowly. Second, the head won't cure. You can read every psychology book, can explain your patterns in three languages, and keep screaming at the child, drinking in the evening, not sleeping at night. Because knowledge is in the head, and the program is in the body. And to reach the body, you need a different path. Through breathing, through movement, through practice that requires no understanding, through a breath. Third, find people who've been through it. Not therapists, people. Those who were at the bottom and got out. A CA groups, meetings, living people in a room. Because until you see with your own eyes that it's possible, you won't believe. Fourth, willing to believe is enough. You don't need to believe in God, in the program, in the therapist, in yourself. It's enough to be willing to try. Willing to sit and close your eyes for 5 minutes, even if you feel nothing. Fifth, it's long. Not days, months. Not months, years. Setbacks will happen. Relapses will happen. This is normal. This doesn't mean it's not working. This means the body is restructuring. Sixth, start with the body, not the head. The head already knows everything. And that knowledge doesn't help. Start with breathing. With yoga, with any movement that makes the body feel itself. Seventh, find your own language for the program. A CA says, God as we understand him. My God is me. My higher power is the inner parent I grew. Yours may be different, nature, music, God himself, doesn't matter. What matters is that you have a foothold. Eighth, reparenting is not a pretty word. It's daily work. Every morning, kind voice instead of critic. Every time you want to punish yourself, a pause. Like learning a new language. At first clumsy with an accent, with mistakes. Then freer. Then it becomes yours. Ninth, this book is not a substitute for therapy. A program. A group. It's a map. It shows where the turns are, but walking is up to you. Tenth, you don't have to be strong to begin. The first step is admitting powerlessness, not strength. Powerlessness. You begin not because you're strong, but because you're tired. Chapter the formula I took away. Healing works on three levels simultaneously ahead. Name it. See the pattern. Give a name to what's happening. A CA, four-step, inventory, journal, chat, GPT analysis. First level. Necessary but insufficient. Body, live it. Breathing, yoga, kundalini, movement. Reach what the head doesn't remember, but the body stores. Relax the body. Feel the spasm and allow it to pass. Not analyzing, not understanding, simply allowing. Second level. Without it, the head spins in neutral. Knows but doesn't change. Soul. Let go. Forgiveness. Reparenting. Kind voice. Meditation. Connection to something bigger. Third level. Without it, eternal fight with yourself. With it, peace, not immediately, not fully, but peace. No level works alone. 20 years on the head alone didn't help. Only when all three connected, with reparenting, soul, did things start to move. Sadhguru's practices worked through the body, not through conversation, not through analysis, not through understanding why, through hatha yoga poses, through breathing, through breath retention, through what happens when you sit in a certain position and breathe a certain way, and the body starts responding. Muscles clench and release. Blood flows to where it left 20 years ago. Fears exit through chattering teeth. Clamps release through trembling. The body corrects itself, and you just sit and breathe, learning to trust the body. I'd later formulate it this way. Your muscles are out of balance because of stress, because of emotions and emotions, because of life events and thoughts. And through poses and breathing, you correct the body, along the way changing your thinking and healing. There's your yoga, your spirituality, your enlightenment, in my integration synthesis. My integration synthesis, and that was the main discovery. Not Sadhguru separately, not ACA separately, not breathing separately, but all together. Head, ACA, naming, steps, inventory. Body, Sadhguru, breathing. Yoga, Surya, Namaskar. Soul, reparenting, kind voice, rituals. Three wings instead of one. My whole life, only the head. Body and soul drag behind like cargo you don't carry but drag. Now, for the first time, all three work together. After Shunya, I started doing Surya every day. Felt the body restructuring, the pelvis opening slowly, what had been held closed, bones aligning, breathing deepening, not because I tried to breathe deeper, but because the clamps were leaving and air had more room. Clamps left, millimeter by millimeter, every day, air had more room, and precisely after Sadhguru, I made the decision that changed everything, not philosophical, behavioral. I declared myself my own higher power. Not I'm all powerful, not I control everything, not Phoenix, not a robot, but a different me, the one inside, the one the ACA program calls loving parent, my panther, my totem animal, which revealed itself to me at 25 during my first meditation, the one Dispenza calls the elevated self, the one Jung calls the self, the center that is larger than the ego, but is still you. He said that the image of God and the self are psychologically indistinguishable, that to search for God outside is to search for yourself in the wrong direction. The one Sadhguru simply calls you and says, leave God alone. Work on yourself. Look inside. The higher self. Not God outside, God inside. I stopped waiting. Stopped waiting for a mother who'd come and say, I'm sorry, I'm here. Stopped waiting for Vitya to wake up kind. Stopped waiting for a therapist to find the key. Stopped waiting for God to take the pain. Stopped waiting for someone outside to say, now you can live. Now me, myself, every day. Surya, breathing, ACA, kind voice. Not because I believe it will help, but because there's no one else. And this, for the first time in my life, doesn't frighten. It frees. I'm not fixing myself. I'm filling the cracks with gold. Kintsugi. Every seam in plain sight. every seam. My story. A golden bowl more beautiful than a whole one, because it's more honest. Sadhguru's practices worked through the body, not through conversation, not through analysis, not through understanding why, through hatha yoga poses, through breathing, through breath retention, through what happens when you sit in a certain position and breathe a certain way, and the body starts responding. Muscles clench and relax. Blood flows to where it left 20 years ago. Fears exit through chattering teeth. Clamps release through trembling. The body corrects itself, and you just sit and breathe, learning to trust the body. I'd later formulate it this way. Your muscles are out of balance because of stress, because of emotions, and emotions because of life events and thoughts. And through poses and breathing, you correct the body, along the way changing your thinking and healing. There's your yoga, your spirituality, your enlightenment, and my integration synthesis. My integration synthesis, that was the main discovery. Not Sadhguru separately, not ACA separately, not breathing separately, but all together. Head, ACA, naming, steps, inventory. Body, Sadhguru, breathing, yoga, Surya Namaskar. Soul, reparenting, kind voice, rituals. Three wings instead of one. My whole life, only the head. Body and soul drag behind like cargo you don't carry but drag. Now, for the first time, all three work together. After Shunya, I started doing Surya every day. Felt the body restructuring, the pelvis opening slowly, what had been held closed, bones aligning, breathing deepening, not because I tried to breathe deeper, but because the clamps were leaving and air had more room. Clamps left, millimeter by millimeter, every day. Air had more room. And precisely after Sadhguru, I made the decision that changed everything. Not philosophical, behavioral. I declared myself my own higher power. Not I'm all powerful. Not I control everything. Not Phoenix, not a robot, but a different me. The one inside. The one the ACA program calls loving parent. My panther. My totem animal, which revealed itself to me at 25 during my first meditation. The one Dispenza calls the elevated self, the one Jung calls the self, the center that is larger than the ego but is still you. He said that the image of God and the self are psychologically indistinguishable, that to search for God outside is to search for yourself in the wrong direction. The one Sadhguru simply calls you and says, leave God alone, work on yourself, look inside, the higher self, not God outside, God inside. Not the one you pray to, but the one you become when you stop running from yourself. I stopped waiting. Stopped waiting for a mother who'd come and say, I'm sorry, I'm here. Stopped waiting for Vidya to wake up kind. Stopped waiting for a therapist to find the key. Stopped waiting for God to take the pain. Stopped waiting for someone outside to say, now you can live. Now, me, myself, every day. Surya, breathing, ACA, kind voice. Not because I believe it will help, but because there's no one else. And this, for the first time in my life, doesn't frighten. It frees. Head, body, soul. No path works alone. I flew on one wing for 20 years. Now, on three. This was my map. It came from my pits, so it's accurate only for me. But the pits are similar. Not an instruction, a compass. Works only if you walk. Here is what I understood over all this time. Not as theory, as lived experience. In the body, not in the head. Reparenting in kind voice. Through the soul. Through ACA. Through meditation. Through the daily choice to speak to yourself differently. This is the third wing. Without it, eternal war with yourself. With it, peace. But the pits are similar. If you're reading this and recognizing yourself, perhaps this compass will work for you too. Not an instruction, a compass. Works only if you walk.